Welcome back to the second half hour of The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. When it comes to the search for man's meaning, we don't have to look any further than that bucket of goo that we've got locked inside our brains and our skulls. So that's what Daniel Bohr argues in his book, The Ravenous Brain, How the New Science of Consciousness Explains Our Insatiable Search for Meaning. We invite you to join the conversation as we talk about how we look at the world and we interpret the world and what excites us visually, audio, you know, what just makes you see the world and put meaning onto the world. The number to call is 614-8980. If you've got questions or comments for our guests, just give us a call. You can also email those questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. I'll read those comments on the air. Go to the comments section on our website, tpr.org, and you can also go to a Facebook page on Facebook. So let me welcome Dr. Daniel Bohr to The Source.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the ravenous brain. So when you talk about what ravenous means, that we just can't get enough. It's a vessel that cannot be filled.
Yes. Humans have, I would argue, an extreme form of consciousness, which makes us ravenous to search for and find patterns around us. And that's what I mean by ravenous.
So patterns, and so the search for patterns, which would be critical for a wild, early evolutionary human being in the savanna, looking for means of survival, trying to figure out where the food or water is going to be, that the patterns are, that's where it comes from.
Yeah, I think consciousness has a clear evolutionary role, and that's particularly apparent in humans or early hominids, if you go back hundreds of thousands of years, if they found certain patterns. So one example might be, for instance, if you put food on a fire that's not otherwise digestible, that makes it digestible. And you can see all these different kinds of foods together. Whatever you use, that makes it more easy to digest, gives you more energy. That innovation itself, that kind of pattern, helps you survive. And if you add all those up, that makes hominids more and more likely to have a greater consciousness and a greater search for patterns, and gives rise eventually to humans, and we're completely obsessed by them.
And so, but that's this answers the thing about being able to figure out where food is, and that's a far cry from figuring out I am me, I am an individual, and I have some sort of purpose on this planet, and I must figure out what that is. Did that evolve from the search for patterns?
Well, I think in terms of purposes, we're built to survive and reproduce from evolution. And that's the primary purpose for all species on the planet, humans included. Sometimes we don't think that's true, but it definitely is true. And that's not so much related to consciousness, but our extreme consciousness at the same time makes us extremely good at surviving, so we can survive in any environment on the planet, or even in space, which is incredible if you think about it.
Yeah, the most hostile of environments.
Absolutely, yeah.
So here we are creating, this love of patterns. Patterns just excite the eye when you see them. It's a design technique used all the time. And patterns that we hear, Mozart, excite the ear. So it does something for the brain. We just love that.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's a critical feature of consciousness.
And then when we talk about consciousness, we're talking about, being self-aware, right?
Well, I think we're talking about being aware. Self-awareness, I think, is a separate issue. I don't think you need to be self-aware to be conscious. So there may be some animals, for instance, that don't really have... Self-awareness is a tricky issue, but they don't necessarily have self-awareness, but I'd still think we'd want to call them conscious.
Right, so we want to talk... So there's different levels of consciousness.
Yes.
And so that my level of consciousness, being aware, is more developed than my dog Jojo.
I think we'd all agree with that, surely.
I don't know how my wife feels about that, though.
Oh, right.
But my dog certainly is, obeys commands. I can point. It can go follow that, which is unique in the animal world. Not even monkeys can follow a pointed hand. It understands some basic commands. It looks at my face. It knows what my mood is. So it certainly has a level of intelligence.
Absolutely. And I'd say a high level of consciousness. but not compared to humans. We just have an extreme form of consciousness.
Right. And so when we, but then we have other animals that we use for, say, like in our food chain, that may not be as, you know, as intelligent, and we're able to accept eating them, having them as part of our diet. Is that because we feel ethically that because it has a lower level of intelligence and lower level of consciousness that it is acceptable to eat a fish? I mean, I'm asking you an ethical question. I know you're not, yeah. You know, that's not your thing, but doesn't that kind of seem to be the way people work?
Yeah. So with the caveat that I'm not an ethicist, I'm a scientist, but just talking from a personal point of view, I personally am a vegetarian because I think, based on the evidence, many other animals, especially mammals, have enough awareness and therefore enough capacity for suffering that I'm not going to put them through that by my diet. So that's the stance I take. And I honestly think that a lot of people don't actually go through the arguments in their heads, and they just say, right, I'm hungry, I fancy a burger, that's what I'll eat. They don't question whether how much consciousness a cow has.
So we have a relationship with dogs. We know that they have a consciousness and intelligence. And so it was totally unacceptable to, I want a dog burger. That's not going to work.
Yeah, because of personal reasons, because you have that relationship, exactly as you say, then you have ethical issues with that. But a dog may be just as bright as, say, a pig. Probably is. But you have no problems eating some pork, or some people don't.
Right.
So there is an inconsistency there, and I think that's partly because people don't really actively look at the evidence or think about these things carefully enough.
And so do you think that I went to your event last night with the Mind Science Foundation. It was great. And you talked about the questions of animal rights, and that this all is, as we talk about consciousness, it leads to these questions about animal rights.
Mm, absolutely. And one interesting thing to note is many consciousness researchers, Christoph Koch is a very prominent one, tend to be vegetarians, actually.
Okay. Well, another thing, we're about to go to break in a couple of minutes, but this is another interesting part of what you bring about in the book, is about how the brain is changed through sometimes through physical damage or also through stimuli that we take, like coffee or alcohol, and that changes consciousness.
Absolutely. And so all these little hints we have demonstrate that consciousness is a brain-based process.
So this is a physical thing. We have a computer, to put it blandly, in our brain that kind of, you know, excretes consciousness.
I'm not so sure I'd use the word excretes, but I agree with you.
And so that's the product of that. And so when the computer gets damaged, then there's the consciousness is damaged.
Absolutely.
And so what is to be taken from that? I mean, why observe that? Why make note of that?
Well, to neuroscientists, that's an obvious fact on the whole. But to many of the public, it's not. Many of the public just assume intuitively that our consciousness is in some ways separate from our brains. And that just isn't true.
Okay, we're going to talk more about that when we come back. We want to get callers in on the conversation. The number is 614-8980. You can also email me your questions at thesource@tpr.org. And we will be right back. And welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking to Dr. Daniel Bohr. He's the author of the book, The Ravenous Brain, How the New Science of Consciousness Explains Our Insatiable Search for Meaning. And he was at last night's the Mind Science Foundation event, speaking to the crowd. It was like a sellout event at Pearl. It was quite an event. So let me ask you, why is this the new science of consciousness? What is new about this? I thought we've been looking at consciousness for years, for since time.
Well, actually, for most of that time, including up to around the late 20th century, scientists steered clear of consciousness, and it was left to the domain of philosophers, and scientists just assumed it was too difficult a subject to study. But actually, Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of DNA, decided after he basically solved life, he'd now try and solve another great mystery, consciousness. And because such a prominent scientist in the late 80s, early 90s got involved, then that became a much more acceptable field. And now, that's why it's new, so it's only been about 20 years old. But now,
because
it's
people
a very
would
flourishing
think that
field.
Science couldn't hold it, we couldn't examine it, put it under a microscope. Is that
exactly
why?
Yeah. It just seemed on the surface to be intractable to science.
And so we left it up to sort of a mystical mystery thing that, you know, it's my soul or something like that.
Absolutely. And the philosophers would think about whether consciousness is the same as the brain or not. And they have those debates, and scientists just wouldn't get involved.
And personality was also somehow a manifestation of my consciousness.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we saw these incredible stories of examples of people who maybe they got a rod shot through the brain or something, and they didn't kill them, they healed up physically, but we saw incredible changes to their personality. What happened there?
Yes, that's one of the sort of defining examples in neuroscience. So in the mid-1800s, a railroad supervisor called Phineas Gage was working at the railroad, and he shoved in a very large metal pipe into a hole that had dynamite in, and the dynamite exploded and the rod went straight through his head, right through his eye socket, right up to the back of his brain, and actually landed about 60 feet behind him. But he didn't actually lose consciousness, and he was able to walk to the cart and then sit on the cart to the doctor. But over time, as he recovered, because of this physical brain-based damage, his whole personality was changed. And that sort of sent shockwaves throughout the world, and it demonstrated very convincingly that sort of our who we are is generated by our brains.
But he was known to be a stand-up, straight guy, dependable, Rock Gibraltar type of individual before the accident. After the accident, he became more of a shifty huckster kind of a guy.
He completely changed. That's right. So after the accident, he lost his marriage, he lost his job. He became much more sort of immature, disinhibited, taking lots of risks, and just basically messing up his life in lots of ways because of specific damage to his frontal lobes.
And there have been other examples of people with strokes also having parts of their brain, damaged, and also having personalities changed. So this is not a one-time occurrence. This is something that's been observed more frequently as science becomes more aware to what to look for.
Absolutely. And now we've seen thousands and thousands of cases to sort of confirm that damage to the brain can easily lead to damage to personality and even consciousness.
But now we have the science that is able to really look at consciousness. So what are you looking at? How do we determine consciousness? Is there a way to actually put a number to consciousness?
Well, you can do experiments in brain scanning, fMRI scanners, and see which parts of the brain change as conscious levels drop, for instance, when you go to sleep. Or you can look at the brain when someone is awake and normally conscious and see which bits of the brain change as consciousness.
So I can
does.
See what parts are being activated, where the blood flow is going or something, because I'm using up all that sugar and energy to go to figure out where I left my keys.
Exactly. Yeah. So we can do all these kinds of experiments, and we can learn which parts of the brain are most closely related to consciousness, and learn sort of the time scale of it as well, how long it takes for consciousness to kick in, and certain brain waves that are associated with consciousness. And based on all that, we can come up with theories. And one particular theory that I talk about in the book is information integration theory. And that does, as you say, posit a number for consciousness. You can have a sort of meter or gauge of consciousness based on this theory. I mean, it's only one theory in its early days, but it's an exciting advance, and it might mean that sort of in 5-10 years' time, we will be able to actually put a number to how conscious any being is.
And that would be going from like an ant, being able to figure out how conscious an ant is,
In principle, yes.
And then judge that against, an intelligent human being.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I could just imagine the magnitudes of computations that it would take to figure, something like that out.
Yeah, so in this particular theory, information integration theory, it can't really calculate any being beyond sort of a handful of nerve cells, of neurons. But the theory is being changed. There are competing theories that are more practical. So soon it should be the case that we should have a reasonable way of assessing levels of or quantities of consciousness in any given being. It doesn't have to be an animal either. It could be some future computer.
So as we study the consciousness, are we learning some flaws in the consciousness where there's some blind spots?
Well, from my perspective, when equating consciousness with sort of this ravenous appetite for patterns, sometimes we see patterns where no patterns exist, which is basically what superstition is. And humans
and conspiracy theories.
Conspiracy theories as well, definitely. And so humans, unfortunately, are probably the most superstitious species on the planet. So there are definitely problems associated with our huge consciousness. But on the whole, it serves us amazingly well.
All right, let's go to the phones. Tom is standing by. Tom, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
My question relates to some of the propositions made by quantum physicists. They contend that it is, from what their research indicates, that matter comes from consciousness, not vice versa. And I know that's counter to what you're saying. Could you comment on that?
All right, Tom, thank you for that call. That's quite the question.
Yeah, I don't think there's any evidence that matter comes from consciousness, I'm afraid. So I think that's all I need to say.
All right. So let's go back to the phones. We got Linda. She wants to join the conversation. Linda, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks. One question I've always wondered about is, why do humans seem to need to get buzzed, you know, get drunk sometime? I think it's kind of funny. It's almost like you were talking about our consciousness being extreme. It almost seems like we suffer from that, and we kind of want to blunt it sometimes.
Okay. Thank you for your call, Linda. Why do people need to, you know, drink or take drugs or whatever else, or have that impulse to do so?
Well, one reason, particularly in modern society, is that we suffer an awful lot from stress, and that generates mental illnesses in many cases. And some people take alcohol to try and relieve stress, to let go, and that in some ways serves a good purpose for that reason.
Well, wasn't like sort of during the Victorian era, there was the idea that consciousness could also be a curse, or high intelligence could be a curse, and sometimes, you know, like fictional characters like Sherlock Holmes would dope up in order to just have a moment's peace.
That sounds plausible as well, yeah.
I mean, the idea of what consciousness is has changed throughout the years, you know, regardless of the amount of scientific knowledge that we've had. It's from culture to culture.
So consciousness has changed, do you say?
No, our impression of what it is, how we define it, and that has a big impact on the way people, on how people carry themselves.
I think we have various intuitive notions about consciousness, but I think sort of science is where we can define it increasingly accurately, particularly in terms of looking at the brain and how the brain generates consciousness, because that's basically where it's at.
Right, so what about jacking up our consciousness? What about taking it to the next level?
So enhancing consciousness.
Yeah.
Because
there's so much going on, so many patterns that we are ravenous for that we're not seeing right now. But,
yeah.
You know, people, they always want more. And
yeah.
And so is that something that's being developed?
Do you mean in terms of drugs?
Well, not just in drugs, but also enhancements and you know, people work, you know, like, first of all, like memory recall. People want, that's part of consciousness?
Conscious recall of memories, yeah.
Yeah,
by definition.
So do people want, you know, I'm reading, you know, all these websites about the next generation of science, and I'm hearing about implants that allow people to see a broader range of light, you know, lights and things and patterns. So would that be something that we should be looking at?
Well, I think that in terms of boosting our consciousness and our ability to see patterns, life is so complicated now, and anything we can do to help us understand it better is a good thing. One active area of research is drugs, and are there any drugs that can boost our consciousness and our understanding in some way? And some drugs, stimulant drugs, seem provisionally to be doing that, and that's a sort of active area, both of research and ethical
questions. And we do that every day when we pick up a cup of coffee.
You could say that, yeah. And there are some more sophisticated drugs, Ritalin that's taken, and modafinil is another one that people, students take to try and boost their performance in exams. That's actually a very large proportion of the student population, both in the US here and in the UK, take these kind of drugs to boost their exam performance, which is an interesting new development culturally.
And so you've also shown that when people have hyper-focus on a particular thing, when they're watching like a card trick, that they are blind to so many other events that are going on around them. We've seen the gorilla experiments where there's supposedly a gorilla walking through and people don't even see it because they're focused on something else.
Absolutely. In some ways, surprisingly, consciousness is very limited and we can only hold on to about 3 or 4 items in our conscious minds at any one time.
And so we leave ourselves vulnerable to a tiger jumping out of the woods to get us.
Absolutely. Missing key details of the world, yes.
All right. Well, I want to thank Daniel Bohr, the author of The Ravenous Brain, here to The Source. It was great talking with you. We're out of time. I want to say that Paul Flabs, the show's producer, Wayne Kobles, the TPR program director, Chris Udaly is our web producer. We get production help from Catherine Dixon. I'm David Martin Davies. Check us out online at tpr.org. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.